I've always struggled with finding time to manage my finances. At the end of a busy week, the last thing I want to do is spend time budgeting all of my expenses or tracking down customer service teams to cancel old subscriptions I no longer use. But now I use Rocket Money, and it does all that for me. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Stop wasting money on the things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Washington Post. That's rocketmoney.com/Washington Post.
So when I was in preschool, I was starting to say like, Anna's a dumb name. It's a girl name. And yeah. My mom was like, you're a girl. And I was like, no, that's a lie. And so I knew it was it's just the classic story of like knowing at a really young age and then unlearning it due to the adults in your life.
Hannah Valenta grew up in California in a conservative Catholic family. They joined the Navy, left home, and over time grew into their identity as a trans, non-binary person.
When I was 29, I was at a friend's wedding and met another person who was non-binary. And they were just glowing. And I was like, wait a second, is that allowed? We can do that? Really?
Hannah is one of hundreds of people who participated in a new survey from the Washington Post and the Kaiser Family Foundation. This is the largest non-governmental survey of transgender adults in the U.S. to rely on random sampling methods.
It provides the kind of data that policymakers and advocates for transgender people say are necessary in order to really understand the needs of trans people and to support them.
Fennett Neeropil covers health and science for The Post. He's been one of the reporters digging into all of this data about the experience for trans people at work, in school, and in the healthcare system.
We're in a moment in the United States right now where the rights of transgender people are starting to come under scrutiny. And there's a wave of bills introduced in state legislatures to restrict gender-affirming care, who can play sports, access to bathrooms that match your gender identity.
Last month, Arkansas passed a law prohibiting doctors from treating transgender youth.
A bill that would ban transgender people from playing in female sports is now law in Kentucky.
The Let Them Grow Act, and it would ban gender-affirming care for those under the age of 19 in Nebraska if it's passed into law.
And that's the broader context here. In this climate, we're trying to highlight the voices and the perspectives of transgender people.
From the newsroom of the Washington Post, this is Post Reports. I'm Elahe Izadi. It's Friday, March 24th. Today, what it's like to be trans in America right now. Fennett shares what he learned from this massive data set and how policy and political debates don't always align with the actual experiences of trans Americans.
So there have been a variety of polls and surveys of trans people over the years. Not a lot of them have had that kind of randomized sample that's seen as like the gold standard in polling to make sure that it's most representative of the community that you're trying to poll.
Yeah, like it's one thing to put out a survey and ask a bunch of questions, but we don't know necessarily if those answers are representative of the majority of people. So this gives us that window.
Right. And it can be difficult to poll a small group like transgender people. So it really requires resources and focus that the Post and the Kaiser Family Foundation were able to bring.
Tell me about what stood out most to you about this survey. What were the big takeaways for you and what was most revealing to you about what life is like for trans people in this country?
So when we have this wave of anti-trans bills that I talked about, one of the big disputes here is, aren't people better off for transitioning and seeking gender-affirming care? So this survey demonstrates that yes, for the vast majority of trans adults, living true to their gender identity has made them happier in life in the face of all this bigotry and the hardships that they still face.
And what did the poll reveal about how trans people consider themselves within the gender spectrum?
I think there's often this perception that if you're trans, you're identifying as the opposite gender as the one you were assigned at birth. So think you're raised as a girl and then you identify as a boy, or you're raised as a boy and then you identify as a girl. But what our poll found is that nearly half of trans adults identify as either trans and gender nonconforming or trans and non-binary. They're rejecting the gender binary outright. And it's only about a third that say that they identify as a trans man or a trans woman. And we found that nearly half use they-them pronouns.
Yeah, that's fascinating to me because I think there is also, like, within the political space, there's this debate about pronouns and how commonplace it is to ask people for their pronouns, or even, like, within certain writing conventions, whether you can use they-them pronouns when referring to people. And what you're telling us is that the poll shows that actually half of trans people do use those pronouns.
Right. It's not like an obscure thing. They-them pronouns are very commonly used in this community.
And Fennett, what did the poll reveal about medical procedures and treatments and the experiences of trans people there? I know you cover health, so I'm imagining that you were paying particularly close attention to this element of the survey.
Right. So there's all these bills that are happening right now to target gender-affirming care. One of the key points from this survey is that most transgender people have not actually had transition-related medical treatments. There's like this distinction in transgender healthcare about social transition versus transition-related medical care. So only about 31% of people have actually used hormones, and only about 16% have had a transition-related surgery. Most commonly, what trans Americans report as their care is social transitioning, dressing differently, using a different name.
And Benin, can you just explain what gender-affirming care is?
The idea behind gender-affirming care is it's healthcare that helps a person live a life that's aligned with their gender identity as opposed to one that they were assigned at birth. So, you know, when we're talking about minors, for instance, sometimes gender-affirming care is as simple as giving them support and counseling to use their preferred pronouns, to dress and present in line with their gender identity. But oftentimes with these bills and with some of the public discourse around trans people, the fixation is on hormones or having surgery to change your genitalia. Not many people actually undergo that kind of treatment. And I should also note here that that doesn't necessarily mean that people don't want that kind of medical care, because there are still a lot of barriers for people who to access that kind of care. And those are some of the other key findings from our survey as well.
Did the survey say anything about the amount of discrimination and even harassment that trans people encounter?
To be very clear, like, trans people have described the discrimination, the bigotry they face in their daily lives for decades. It's not a surprise that transgender adults face discrimination or harassment. This survey helps quantify that, though. More than 6 in 10 trans adults say they sometimes or frequently feel discriminated against because of their gender identity. And a 64% majority of trans adults say they've been verbally attacked. And 25% say that they've been physically attacked.
And what about mental health struggles? Are we seeing any evidence of that within this survey? What did the survey say about that?
Trans adults are more than twice as likely to say they've experienced serious mental health problems such as depression or anxiety growing up. It's about 78% versus 32% for American adults overall. We also do hear in the medical context of when you're raised with a different gender identity than the one that you identify with, that does cause a lot of distress. The term is gender dysphoria, and especially when trans people are facing discrimination too, as the survey shows, it's not entirely unsurprising that we would see higher rates of depression or anxiety.
After the break, we hear more from Hannah Valenta, who you heard at the top of the episode, about what accessing healthcare has been like as a trans person in this current climate. We'll be right back.
I've always struggled with finding time to manage my finances. At the end of a busy week, the last thing I want to do is spend time budgeting all of my expenses or tracking down customer service teams to cancel old subscriptions I no longer use. But now I use Rocket Money, and it does all that for me. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Stop wasting money on the things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Washington Post. That's rocketmoney.com/Washington Post.
So, Fennett, you cover healthcare. I want to dig in a bit more about what seeking healthcare was like for the people surveyed. Could you tell us more about Hannah, the person we heard from earlier in the show?
Hannah Valenta was one of the people we talked to.
I grew up in California, and when I was 20 years old, joined the Navy and left and haven't been back.
They're non-binary and live in Florida, but they're actually considering moving out of Florida because of the political climate there, the legislation introduced to crack down on LGBTQ people in public life, and the challenges that they run into going to the doctor in Florida.
I don't feel great about... I live in the South. I don't feel great about being like, hey, I'm non-binary, here are my pronouns. Like, it's not a conversation I feel like I can have because I'm already having so many issues just as a fat person, as female presenting, like having doctors really take me seriously. So I already have like some intersections of difficulty, and adding like the weird thing doesn't help.
So what has Hannah's experience been like coming out and living as a non-binary person?
For Hannah, coming out as non-binary gave them the confidence to express their gender identity with joy.
I think part of what non-binary means to me is just understanding that there are going to be days where like the prescribed clothing or fashion is going to feel really bad, and giving myself the grace to not force myself to do things that make me feel bad.
The challenge that Hannah faces, though, is that they're coming up in a world where institutions don't always respect that kind of gender identity. Hannah served in the military, was raised as Catholic, and then seeks healthcare at the VA, where Hannah says that they don't always feel comfortable coming out as non-binary. Because of the gendered nature of VA, Hannah has to go to a woman's clinic, and then going to a woman's clinic sometimes can be a very uncomfortable experience.
I know you said Hannah is considering moving out of Florida because of these issues. Fennett, what did you hear from people living in more liberal parts of the country? Is there a big difference in the care they're finding?
So what Hannah's story illustrates is that the experiences of trans life don't always fall into these predictable political lines. One of the more interesting poll findings was there wasn't really significant differences in finding healthcare providers who treat trans people with dignity in states won by Donald Trump in 2020 versus states won by President Biden. And part of that is that challenges our notion that just because you're in a Democratic area or a liberal area, it's going to be a very inclusive place for trans people. Because a lot of Americans are still struggling with their acceptance of trans people. And even in big urban cities where you might find more people who are supportive, you also have more opportunities to encounter people who are bigoted or encounter people who are clueless.
Fennett, what are some of the other things that people have shared with you about navigating the healthcare system?
One 70-year-old trans woman I spoke to said that a doctor called her it. A non-binary person I spoke to said that while they were going through an ultrasound, the doctor was asking, why are you using they/them pronouns? One transmasculine person I spoke to moved out of Tennessee as state lawmakers there were passing a raft of bills to restrict gender-affirming care, worried that that restrictions on care for adults would be next. Another person I spoke to for this story was Hans Dirkmat. They're transmasculine, non-binary, use they and he pronouns, and they had an experience where a nurse practitioner wouldn't give them cholesterol medicine, even though they had a history of heart disease in the family. That's because the doctor thought it might interfere with Hans' ability to get pregnant.
I just wanted the pill. But for those couple of years, it was very much so you have your uterus and you can still be pregnant, get pregnant. And if you take this medication, it limits your opportunity to get pregnant because it could give you complications. Even though I stressed several times that I don't want to have children, neither does my wife.
I can imagine there are some major consequences to all of this, especially, you know, going to the doctor can already be a vulnerable thing. You know, like you're going to seek the counsel of a trusted physician. Usually you're in a situation where you want to trust your doctor. You're kind of putting your life in their hands and then you're maybe being treated this way. And I can imagine that it's more wounding than a random person on the street saying this to you. Fennett, what are the ramifications of this sort of behavior in a healthcare setting? What are some of the outcomes that comes out of that?
I think one of the key issues here is that it's not just about seeking gender-affirming care. It's about seeking any sort of medical care. And the concern here is that when you have negative experiences with the healthcare system, when you're being treated poorly, when you don't have trust with doctors, that has negative consequences for your health overall. If you're not seeking preventative care, if medical conditions are going untreated, if you'd end up developing diseases or conditions that could have been avoided. This isn't exclusive to trans people too. This comes up in the context of women having their pain dismissed, for example. It comes up in the context of Black patients having their pain dismissed. So trans people experience a lot of the similar discrimination and hostility in the healthcare system that can have wide-reaching ramifications for their lives.
Did anyone talk about any positive experiences that they had in healthcare settings or ones that were, you know, inspiring to them or, you know, surprised them?
Yes, and I think that's really important too because it's not all bad. There are good doctors out there. There are good welcoming clinics out there. And some of the people I spoke to talked about how meaningful it was to go to a clinic and to be asked what your pronouns are. To go to a clinic and someone not immediately blaming their hormone therapy for whatever problems that they're undergoing. Or just going to the doctor and their transgender identity just not being treated as a big deal. That means a lot to people.
Fennett, I'm so struck by the breadth and rigor of this survey that was conducted, in part because it doesn't sound like this sort of work has been done at this point. So what does it mean to have this information, you know, shored up and verified in this way at this moment in this country right now?
The power of having a randomized sample and a randomized survey is that you can really understand on a systemic level what the experiences of trans people are like. And so I don't want to like act like our poll is the first time that trans people were polled ever. There has been meaningful work done and meaningful research done from the think tank, the Williams Institute, and federal health surveys, but more data is needed. And we hear this coming out from researchers, policymakers, and advocates. Kids that having this kind of data statistically sound using a random sample makes it easier to have a better understanding of the needs of transgender people and to find ways to improve their lives.
Thank you, Fennett.
Thanks so much for having me.
Fennett Narapel covers health and science for The Post. That's it for Post Reports. Thanks for listening. Today's show was produced by Ariel Plotnick. It was mixed by Sean Carter and edited by Maggie Penman. Our team includes Rena Flores, Ted Muldoon, Martine Powers, Lucy Perkins, Eliza Dennis, Alana Gordon, Ariel Plotnick, Arjun Singh, Jordan Marie Smith, Renny Svernovsky, Emma Talkoff, Sean Carter, Maggie Penman, and Renita Jablonski. I'm Elahe Izadi. We'll be back tomorrow with more stories from The Washington Post.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.